Lisa! Lisa! Go on, boy, go on, go on, go on. Off you go, off you go. Good boy, Lisa.
I love this time of the year, you know. When the summer's over but the days are still warm. And the mornings are lovely and crisp. Like this. And the waves are big, crashing onto the beach. And the evenings are drawing in. You kind of feel that the year is moving on. I started coming out here to the beach that September after Michael died. I didn't sleep much anyway. Lying in bed waiting for the morning to come. Had it all to ourselves. The sun coming up over Brownstown. And Lisa barking at me. Racing in and out of the waves.
Lisa! Lisa!
I don't know how I got through that first few months. Jesus, let alone the last few years. Especially after Ashley went back. And Kevin. Oh, Kevin to wherever. Everything just seemed to slow down and come to a stop. What happens now, I thought. What do I do now? The place all quiet. The house empty. Michael gone, the kids gone, and the business, the salon, gone too. I'd seen this card, a flyer, a few months after he died. A self-help group, once a month, bereavement support kind of thing. Met in a hotel, small function room upstairs, of this awful carpet on the floor, and those chairs that they stack on top of each other. 9 or 10 people, mostly women and just 2 men. We watched this video and there was a doctor or someone giving a talk. One of them flip charts, you know. He kept smiling all the time. The stages of grief. Shock, anger, denial, 6 or 7 or something. And then there was a break for coffee. And I was just about to make for the door to go home when a woman sat down beside me. Julie. She had a cup of coffee and a few biscuits in her hand. Them Marietta ones with the little holes in them. Seemed to be as uneasy as I was. And nearly spilled the coffee edge or the chair. Said she'd have to leave shortly. I kind of blurted out about how long her husband was dead. She smiled. My husband isn't dead, she said. A close friend. What about you? My husband, I said. A few months ago he had cancer. He was 44. What was his name? She asked. Michael, I said. Tell me about him, Michael. And I did. You know, I can't remember what I told her about him or about me. I was on Seroquel at the time and then Xanax for a while. You don't have to do this on your own, the GP said. Did I think of getting help, support, you know? So I went back to the counsellor, psychotherapist. Always felt bad about Michael and I, our sessions, encounters as she used to call them. Used to make Michael laugh, that, encounters. Well, she gave me a great big hug when I went in. Make coffee and all. Had one of those handy Nespresso machines. More like a chat than, you know. She was full of praise for me. How well I was doing, considering. Particularly the way things had been between Michael and myself before his illness and that. And having to deal with his death as well. His loss, as she called it. She talked about not bottling it all up inside, to let it go. Whatever it was. Open the vessel, she'd say. Don't keep the lid on the whole time. I told her that sometimes I felt really bad, really angry about everything. Life, you know. The way things had turned out and that. And I told her that other times it felt that all I was doing was letting on. Days, and honestly, it didn't bother me one bit that he was gone. I know it's awful to say, but it was the truth. And then there were other days. Well, Michael and I were long past loving each other. And I told her. And yet here I was trying to grieve for him or letting on to grieve for him. I don't know. Maybe I was just grieving for something else. Something that was dead and gone years ago anyway. I mean, I remember when it came out that he'd started seeing her again. You know, this one he'd had the affair with a few years before. And he'd started going up to Dublin to meet up with her. Supposed to have been on these training courses for school. New syllabus for the Leaving Cert. And while I thought he was at these meetings in the Department of Education or somewhere, he's back in her place, Ranelagh at Mines or somewhere, having it off with her. and had been for months too. That was when we first went to see her, the counsellor. Oh, Michael refused, of course, but I insisted. Last chance for the marriage and all that. Funny, isn't it? I said to her. You live a lifetime with someone. You think you know them. And then they die. And you still don't know who they are. Suppose when I look back now, it had all been fading for years. Year after year, just dying like a bulb or a battery, seeping away. But you never really notice, or want to notice. Always too busy. Always rushing here and racing there. The kids, one after the other, and Michael always in that school. Or me with the hairdressing. And always in a hurry. One of us going out the door as the other was coming in. Must have spent half our lives in that Opel Zafira. Stuck in traffic. On the Dunmore Road somewhere. Under pressure, as they used to say. Ordinary life, you know. Until it struck me the day of Fiona's wedding. Where did it all go? Whole chunks of our lives had whizzed past. Gone. And now, instead of enjoying ourselves, the two of us, now that the kids were all reared, flown the nest and the mortgage paid off, well, almost, and all the worries and all the cares behind us. Instead, here we were, setting on tearing it all apart, tearing each other apart. The Silver Surfers. That's who we were supposed to be. That handsome silver-haired couple you see in those insurance ads strolling hand in hand on endless white beaches. The Silver Surfers. And to think of us in there, in that room. Jesus, and I was dead keen too. Oh yeah, wanting to do it all the right way, you know. To save the marriage. Wanting to do whatever needed to be done, you know. The need for change. Adjusting to the new realities. Confronting the empty nest. All that stuff. Oh yeah, I was all for that. He was the one who wasn't, or didn't want to. Saw it all beneath him. Said it too. To sit in front of a stranger, qualified or unqualified, from some holistic institute in Denmark. Said I was naive to believe, to trust in some stranger. Said it was like going to confession all those years ago. Going into a dark box and confessing your dark secrets. Except that now, he said, you pay for the fucking privilege to some quack. That's what he called her to her face. The poor woman. A quack. A charlatan, he said she was. Which one are you? He sneered. Bobby or Jack? Oh, he thought that was hilarious. You know, charlatan, Bobby or Jack? Yeah, Michael loved that. Always the teacher shone off his learning and his superiority. Even at our closest, you know, our most intimate. He always wanted you to know that he was still in control, in charge. The moon tour, the boss, wouldn't let go, never let go. She asked me once about sex, you know, if we still. Oh, I don't know, maybe I was to blame too. Back then, those years when the kids were grown up, tired, always tired, or the wrong time. And then he wants it, and I didn't, and I couldn't. And between one thing and another, you just... Once Michael half joked that I had gone frigid, you know? Especially when I stopped returning his advances. Frigid. Jesus. I suppose he thought it justified his own carry-on. His affair, the whole thing. All that stuff, and she knew it too. Stuff that neither of us really wanted to talk about or uncover or start picking at or raking over, you know. And in the end you just say, ah, to hell with it. And then, of course, once he was diagnosed, well, that was pretty much the end of all that. She listened and nodded. Don't go beating yourself up over your relationship, your marriage, she said. Admit the truths to yourself. Maybe not today, but over time, the truth will come out. And whatever that truth is, don't blame yourself. It is what it is. And then for one awful moment, I thought she was going to say, we are where we are. And I was either going to burst out laughing or burst out crying. But she didn't. What is it about men and widows? Oh, well, some men anyway. Nothing like a widow to bring the creeps and creeping Jesuses to your door or to your phone. Oh, I've had them all. Well, you know what I mean. heavy breathers and what colour is your knickers types. Oh yeah, and the others too. Don't know me but go for a drink. Still an attractive woman, take it from there. Hugs and kisses and hands all over me arse. Yeah, sure. It's not that you don't want a man around, I mean, or that I wanted Michael that way again. I didn't. Or that you want some living lover boy or the promise of tantric sex till 4 a.m. Or that you spend dull afternoons out in the utility room, line up against the washing machine looking at magazine pictures of Richard Gere or George Clooney. I didn't. It's just that sometimes when you do want a man, it's to fix the lawnmower or check the tank in the attic or to change a bloody tyre in the car. Or just to chat with, or to have a laugh with, or just to be with. Then you can have all the tantric sex you like. And then out of the blue, a fella I used to often meet in the supermarket, usual time, always well turned out, nice clothes, hair always trimmed, shopping for himself. Met him a few times too. Oh, well, not exactly met. We'd pass each other, Friday evenings, same mile. And once, "What's on the menu tonight?" he asks. "Oh, nothing really," says I. "Usual Friday night. News at 9 and then Ryan Tuberty till bedtime. The usual." "No, no," he said. "Food." "Yikes." And for a moment he smiled back. Nice teeth. "Poulet basque for me," he said, pointing to the parcel of chicken in the trolley. "And a nice French to go with it." And then, just for a moment, I thought that he was going to ask me if I'd like to. "Enjoy," he said, nodding to the 4 large Cadbury bars I had in my trolley. Be seeing you." And later, when I was standing at the checkout, I could see him through the big glass windows getting into his car outside in the car park. A 08 Skoda. "Hi, you got up?" "It's not cockcrow, it's nearly 9:30. "Really beautiful out here." "Oh, now run round in the sand and chasing after the seagulls." "Not me, Leaser." "Croissants? There's posh for you. Plan's not good enough for you anymore, eh? Far from croissants, we were aired. Oui, madame." "Oh, listen, will you put that stuff out in the line for me? I put a wash on before I come out. Thanks. And listen, will you get dressed, will you? Waltzing around the place all day in your dressing gown. Fiona and the gang will be down after lunch." "Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bye. Talk to you later. Love you too." When I went back a few weeks later to the meeting, the bereavement thing, I sat down beside Julie and we smiled to each other and got chatting again about the weather or how hard it was to find parking spaces or something. Do you know the way with some people you kind of hit it off from the start? Just something about her. She wasn't all down, you know. Oh, no disrespect now, I mean, I know it was about bereavement. But you know, she just had a way about her. The kind of person you'd find easy to talk to. Always looked well. Beautiful hair too. She'd a colour in it, but done really well, you know. Suited her. I told her to. "How was your week?" she asked, and I raised my eyes to heaven. "Like that, was it?" she said. And again, for no reason, I just welled up in tears. "Come here," she said, and she just hugged me and held me. I thought he might have been a doctor or something over in the hospital. Tesco man. That's what I used to call him. Something about his hands. Clean fingernails. Manicured, you know. And the way he spoke, polite. It wasn't local. Nice bedside manner, I'd say. Often used to think about him. And one Friday evening, silly really, I sat in the car in the car park, near where he usually parks, just waiting for him to come in. Anybody with him or that, a wife or a partner or someone. And I was going to get out of the car when he passed and kind of go all surprised-like when we'd bump into each other. Sat there for a long time too, listening to the radio, cars coming and going, just gazing out at people, packing their shopping or some idiot trying to get the car exactly between the white lines. Just looking out for Tesco man. And for some reason it came into my head. The consultant, the last time Michael and I were with him, in the hospital in Dublin. And I remember his hands. He had these beautiful hands, lovely long fingers and perfect nails, just like Tesco man. I was looking at them, admiring them. And he was telling us, the consultant, he was telling us that it was time to put our affairs in order. poor choice of words, I remember thinking. Time was running out, he said. And sitting there in the car on my own in the car park, t'was as if I was back in that consultant's room, and he was talking to us, very slowly and very quietly. And he was saying something about palliative care. But all I could hear was a Garda car siren somewhere outside on the Merrion Road. Cancer came at a really inconvenient time for us, you know. Going through a marriage breakup's enough to be going on with. Those last few weeks, Jesus, he was on the morphine pump then. Hospice nurse coming to the house. I used to sit with him through the night, and often I'd put on some music for him, a little iPod thing beside the bed. Someone told me once that what you needed to deal with terminal cancer was lots of love, lots of morphine, and a little whiskey. Yeah. And I remember thinking, there'd be no problem with the morphine or the whiskey. It's the first one that'll be the hardest. For me, anyway. But I tried. The whiskey, too. And then one night when I was sitting with him and he woke suddenly, he was all agitated and confused. So I went to him and I held him. And he whispered the word, Crete. Said it a few times. Crete. In Greece. Our honeymoon. An old framed photo on the cabinet in the sitting room. And he's coming out of the sea after a swim. And he's all tanned and strong and handsome. Those light blue shorts on him. And a smile like a film star. Crete. And I brought the photo over to show him. Held it for him. And the strangest thing. A little later that night when I was sitting with him, dozing off in that chair beside the bed, I had a dream about Crete. And I'm standing on that beach, looking out at Michael swimming in the sea. And I'm watching him swim further and further out into the Aegean. And once or twice he turns and he waves to me from off in the distance. It's a scorching hot day. The sun golden in a beautiful blue sky. The most beautiful day you could imagine. And then all of a sudden he's in trouble. Current or something. And I race out to the tide and I swim as fast as I can, thrashing and kicking and I call out in a panic. Michael, Michael, where are you, Michael? And just then I can see him surface. And I swim against the current to get over to him, but it's dragging him further and further away, his arms and legs flailing. And then I reach for him. I grab his arm just out of the water, but it's all slippy and greasy from the suntan cream or something. And just as I have a grip on his wrist, his hand slides through mine and then he's gone. And I scream, Michael, don't go, please, Michael, don't. Don't die, please. He's buried in that new cemetery over there just behind the beach. What he always loved, the sea, and to be near it. And often I imagine on some stormy night and the sea raging or in a high spring tide and the place flooded and he's carried off. Out onto the tide, along the back strand, past the Saline, out into the bay, and out past the Metal Man, carried along the waves and the tides, and off out to the wide dark seas, forever.
Here, Lisa, here, boy. There's a good boy. Ah, don't go shaking yourself all over me like that, will you?
The next meeting she wasn't there. Didn't see her for a few weeks. Thought she'd stop going. And then out of the blue I got a phone call. Julie. I just couldn't look at that carpet anymore, she joked. Or those awful Marietta biscuits. I burst out laughing. We arranged to go out for something to eat that Thursday night. Gnocchi roulade is nice if it's done right. I love Italian and that's my favourite. I hadn't been eating much. I nearly lost a stone the previous few months. But I finished off what was on my plate. And all the garlic bread as well. With a few glasses of wine between us two. Well, more than a few, actually. She came in and had a coffee when the taxi dropped me home. We were chatting for hours. She's great company. a grey crack. Hadn't felt like that in ages. Said we'd go out again in a couple of weeks. Later was thinking just as I was getting ready for bed. Maybe I should do something with my hair for Christmas, like.
Rudolph. Rudolph. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose.
It's no sooner Halloween and Christmas starts. Gets earlier every year. At least it feels like it. I only seem to have put all this stuff away and I'm climbing up into the attic to bring it all back down again. We've had all these decorations and these Christmas lights since the kids were small. Got the excitement when we bring the stuff down. And the Christmas ads came on the telly. I don't know who was more excited, me or the kids. And then on Christmas Eve, trying to get the four of them off to bed. And then off to sleep. And Kevin, he was a divil. Up and down the stairs. Did he come yet, Mammy? Did he come yet? Santa? No, he didn't. Get back up them stairs, will you? Couldn't wait for Santa. And then on Christmas morning, such excitement. I dreaded that first Christmas after Michael died. They were all here. It was just great having the house full again. Fiona and Paddy are coming down from Dublin with the twins. And Aisling is due in from JFK on Christmas Eve. So they'll collect her from the airport and they'll all come down together. We're looking forward to it for ages. Probably need a trailer as well as a top box for all the gear they bring. And a sleigh for all the toys as well. £50 for a Christmas tree. I must be mad. Nice though. I wouldn't have one of them artificial ones. Not the same, is it? No. Suppose that's why they're called artificial. We nearly got electrocuted with these lights one year. Do you know that? Yeah, Michael and myself. Christmas Eve. The kids all tucked up in bed waiting for Santa. And the place like a Christmas card. Not snowing now. But frosty, you know. And these lights and the colours of them flashing on and off. Place hanging down with decorations. Toys and presents all over the place. Laid out like a toy shop window the house was. And we'd have on a CD. Christmas songs, you know. Creating the atmosphere like. And we're sitting there in front of the blazing fire. The two of us, kids in bed. A bit of peace and quietness. Place to ourselves at last. And only the lights of the Christmas tree flashing on and off here. And we're sitting on our beautiful new carpet only laid a few weeks earlier. And after all the glasses of wine and I was after drinking and the whiskies that he'd knocked back while we were getting the presents ready. Well, we were a little bit worse for wear, I'd say. And then with the lovely Christmas music and the heat from the roaring fire and all that, well, Christmas feeling, well, we started to get all cuddly and romantic, stretched out in our lovely new carpet in front of the fire. And of course one thing led to another, and by now I think my blouse and bra are off, and I think Michael's new Christmas jumper and shirt have gone as well. I'm all giddy and full of giggling and laughing, half naked, the two of us rolling around like idiots, when all of a sudden the sitting room door crashes in. Did he come yet? Santa! Kevin and the three girls standing there, staring at his mouths wide open. We thought we heard Santa. And then in a panic we jump up, the two of us, and try and push the four of them back out the door again. But doesn't Michael trip over the wire for the Christmas tree lights, pulls it straight out of the socket, and the tree, the whole bloody thing starts to topple over. Jesus! And there's this white flash, and every light in the house goes out. The whole place in darkness, and the kids screaming. Some Christmas Eve. We'd a right laugh about it the last time Fiona was down. The good old days. She doesn't talk much about their years growing up here. Fiona doesn't. Rachel's the only one who'll talk about home. Home, sweet home. Of course, it's probably easier for her being in Australia than that. Suppose you could say she's distanced herself from it all. Can't get much further away, I suppose. Kevin never talks about it. Or his dad. Always changes the subject. And men are funny like that. I saw him look at me the last time he was home. Why are you dyeing your hair? He asked. Just to change, I said. Julie thought it looked great. You know, a complete new hairstyle. I am a hairdresser after all, I smiled. And then he said, next I suppose you'd be going around in tight denim jeans, leather boots and wearing sunglasses in the top of your head, even though it's the middle of winter. Yeah. Just the way he said it, you know. Just like his father. Sarcastic. Hurtful even. He hasn't been down for a while now. but not after the row we had the last time. It seems he doesn't approve of the company I keep. He'll phone, though, Christmas Day. Probably do the Skype thing. Oh, look, there's that old laughing Santa. And my old Santa hat still fits me. God, what am I like? It's all a bit of a fiasco, actually, Christmas. Yeah. Paddy Fiona's husband put his back out the day before Christmas Eve. Couldn't move an inch. So he was confined to bed for the whole day. And there was no way they could travel down. And the roads were very bad anyway, and with all the cold weather we had. Just as well all the Santa stuff was still in their house in Clontarf and not down here. So Fiona had to do the whole thing herself. Aisling's flight was cancelled because of that snowstorm in New York. Most of the East Coast was hit, worst in a century. So she was on the phone crying Christmas Day, sitting in her apartment up in the Bronx, snowed in, and the city on lockdown. All flights grounded in and out of JFK for 4 days. Rachel was on, of course, from Sydney. Phone from the beach, 35 degrees. And the gang of nurses she hangs round with, and that big fat one from Mooncoyne, pissed out of her mind. And she shouted down the phone to me, "Go on, Kilkenny, up the cats, from Australia." Kevin didn't phone. Probably wait until New Year's Eve. Free text worldwide with Vodafone. I never really liked being in someone else's house for Christmas, for me own. So anyway, when I phoned Fiona Christmas Eve and suggested I drive up, she nearly had a fit. "On those roads, the M50's like a skating rink," she said. "Don't attempt to sit into that car." And anyway, Paddy might be okay for New Year's Eve. And by then, hopefully, the weather'll have improved. And that they'd be down and we could have our Christmas dinner on New Year's Day. No point in her cooking a Christmas dinner if Paddy was out of action. So she'd put the turkey and ham into the freezer and bring them down when they're coming. "The kids would get a great kick out of it," she said. "You know, Santa's second time. And a full Christmas dinner laid on." Yeah. And guess who'll be doing all the catering? Julie won't be back from the Canaries until January. She likes to go to the sun for Christmas and the New Year. Said she hates the dark days and all that carry on. Prefers to stay out there till it's all over. It's a lovely chat though, Christmas Day. Pity she's not around. So there I was with the house to myself. Oh, there wasn't much point in cooking a turkey and ham, for they weren't coming down till New Year's Eve. So I did a spaghetti bolognese. Opened a nice bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape. French. Expensive. But hey, it's Christmas. And I worked my way through a few of these selection boxes and a couple of these Altinza Cadbury's roses. They're after changing the flavours. Smaller too. You know, with all the bloody TV channels, I ended up watching a DVD. Your man, Omar Sharif. Dr. Zhivago. As if there wasn't enough snow and ice around. Julie Christie was nice though. I'm able to run 5K. Imagine. That's 3 miles, no money. But not since January. All Julie's idea. As soon as she got back from the Canaries, a New Year's resolution and all that. Oh, when she sets her mind on something. We're going to run at the Women's Mini Marathon in Dublin in June for the hospice. Sponsorship, you know. We joined up with this women's group 3 nights a week. It started as a walking group and then it got a little faster. So now we're a running group. Well, most of the time. Hail, rain or snow, out in the road. I love it. So does Julie. That winter, by midweek, I was usually looking forward to Fiona and the lads coming down the weekend. The house always seemed to come alive as soon as the car pulled in. The noise and the excitement of the twins until bedtime. And then Fiona and myself would usually stay up till all hours, chatting over a few glasses of wine. But slowly that miserable January faded into February and the evenings got brighter. I just wanted that first winter to be over. Seemed to go on forever too. Always looking out for the stretch in the evenings. The cock step, waiting for spring. Easter eggs in the shop for Patrick's Day. We become kind of regulars in that Italian place, Julie and I. And then a couple of drinks in that pub just around the corner. "Your usual table, ladies," your man, the owner, would say when we'd go in. Became a kind of saying between us. Regular thing. I'd pay one night and she'd pay the next. Julie always wanted to take the bill, but I insisted. I'm not out in the road yet, I used to joke. At the time, I was waiting for Michael's insurance and all that to be settled up. She was a great help to me. She's an accountant. She was good like that. Has her own firm. Name and a brass plate at the front door. She'll be with me, the two of us, when I meet the bank next week. Hard to believe going back in there. The same office Michael and myself signed up to that new loan for the salon. He was in the full of his health then, and so was the economy, or so we thought. Celtic Tiger and all that. The bank, arse licking all over us. How are all the family? How do they grow up so quickly? Your woman, the assistant manager, joking about hair extensions. Must pop in to see us when the new salon is open. But 6 months later, the bloody country went belly up. And 12 months later, we were in there again. Two fellas with their jackets off, shirt sleeves rolled up, and your woman, the assistant manager, scowling at us, faces all tightened like thugs. We loaned you the money. You must make the repayments. Do you think the bank is a charity? Says your woman. So you're well off. Isn't he a teacher, for God's sake? Job for life. Print out of all our monthly spending on the table. Look at these, says another fella. Sky TV, golf club, gym membership, Ryanair flights all over Europe, and a fucking holiday home in Portugal. Jesus. And he laughs. And look at this. A car loan for a brand new Pajero Jeep. Jesus Christ. Michael never opened his mouth. And then we were coming out of the office, a queue of people at the ATM machines looking at us. I was crying, my mascara run down my face. You won't take my business, I shouted back in the door at them. Bastards. But they did. Took the salon and the place in Portugal. And the Pajero back to the garage. Would have taken the house too, nearly did. But I suppose by then the business just wasn't there anymore. Just stopped spending, people did. That October, like you flicked a switch, died on its feet, the country did, and my hairdressing business. The place has been boarded up the past few years. One of the units beside it lasted a while, but the rest of the place empty. I often look in the windows when I'm passing, going in and out of the supermarket, exactly as we left it, that Tuesday I closed out the door. Same magazines lying on the floor. All the equipment was sold off, but the sinks and everything still there. Place covered in dust. There was talk of a Peter Marks something taking it over, but nothing came of it. And then in town one day a few weeks ago, I met one of the girls who worked at me. Heard you're opening up again, she says. News to me, I smiled. Word travels fast in a small town. It's funny how you get to know someone you like. I mean, you've never met them before and probably wouldn't have, only something brings you together. And you just seem to hit it off. I know I was always good with people. In the salon, like. Even when I started as a young one all those years ago. They always said it about me. That I had a great way with the customers, the clients. A people person, they call it nowadays. But I am. I just like people. And I suppose I get on with them. Michael was the opposite. Went out of his way to avoid people. Kept his distance. Always. Reserve, he called it. But Julie's different. Talk for hours, the two of us. I told her all about Michael and myself. Personal things, you know, private. The affair and the counselling and all that. Not that it was a secret or anything. Jesus, half the town knew. And the half that didn't found out about it later. But just talking to her about that kind of thing, you know. Things that I wouldn't dream of telling or saying to anyone else. And she isn't nosy either. Never prying or anything. She's good like that, Julie is. Trusting, you know. Generous too. We get on great. A real friend.
The summer wind came blowing in from across.
You can't step into the same river twice. Saw it on a poster in the back of the door in her office. The counselor. I think it means that nothing stays the same. Everything changes in life. True for people too. Suppose you could say that I'm not the same person I was when Michael died. Not anymore. And it's not that I wanted to be rid of him. To die, I mean. But who knows what would have become of us if he hadn't got sick like that. We were certainly on a journey somewhere. And whether we would have stayed together or split up, who knows? There's times I know when I was so sure that it was all over. And I know he was too. It's just a case of deciding how to end it. Make a decision or to just let it all fizzle out and walk away. And God knows those days when I would gladly have, you know, walked away. It was here, actually. Just up there. The car park that first night. We drove out from town in his old red Ford Escort, that passion wagon. The dark of the night and all the stars glistening on the sea. And he let back the seats. The car dark and the green lights on the dashboard. And the car radio on low. Some pirate station playing love songs. His arm around me and my fingers through his thick wavy hair that I'd washed that first time he came into the salon a few weeks before. And later we made our way along the rocks and the stones down to the beach, to the water's edge, with the light of the moon and the stars all over the bay. And off in the distance beyond Brownstown, you could see the light from the lighthouse over in Dunmore East as it whipped across the sky. And he spread his coat out down on the soft, dry sand, and we lay on our backs looking up at the night sky. And the longer you stared up into the dark, the clearer the stars became. You could see them glistening and sparkling way off out in the Milky Way, whatever they call it. And now and then, a falling star would race across the sky and then disappear. "Make a wish," he said. And I did. And I wished that that moment would last forever. And I whispered it into his ear. "You shouldn't tell," he said. "Supposed to be a secret." "Do you think we will, Michael?" I asked. "Last forever." That was the first time, that was. We did it, you know. Only gone out together a few weeks. Under the stars. Isn't that romantic? And we lay there, the sound of the white waves breaking over the dark strand and the silver stars glistening above us in the heavens. We lay there until I started to get cold, and he held me so close and so warm, fell asleep in his arms. But even with him holding me, I started to shiver. And then in a panic when we got back up to the car, and the car would start. The battery had run down with the lights and the radio on so long. And Michael effing and blinding as he tried the ignition over and over. A couple of fellas going down fishing for the night helped us to get it going. Used to laugh about it years afterwards. Said he needed jump leads that first night to put a bit of life into me. "Moral never need a vibrator," he used to joke. "As long as there's a set of jump leads out in the shed." Ha ha ha, very funny. I remember telling Julie one night about the jump leads. She thought it was hilarious. Often think of it when I come down here in the mornings. "We don't get a set of instructions when we find a partner in life," the counsellor said. "There's no owner's manual. But if there was one, there would be a few pages of terms and conditions. The small print. Relationships come with terms and conditions." I remember nodding intensely in agreement. Michael was sitting there, a smirk on his face, raising his eyes to heaven. "Caveat emptor," he says under his breath. "Caveat emptor. You probably wouldn't know it," he says to her. "But that's Latin. It means buyer beware." Julie saw the auctioneers about the salon. "Made an appointment. Just an inquiry," she said. "A client, all confidential. Michael's life insurance policy helped me clear some of the original loan. And we're restructuring the new mortgage on the salon. She looked after the whole financial side of things. There's a bit of legal work involved, but the bank seemed to be happy. Julie's dead keen. Timing is everything," she says. She's like all those accountants. "Bottom line is only a number," she says. "Between us, we'll make the repayments all right. Commercial property will be a winner in the long run," she says. "Even down here." God, when I thought about it, I nearly had a weakness. I had to sit down and calm myself. "But you know, it's my life," I thought. "I won't live forever. Julie's really fired up about it. Actually, we both are." It was for a weekend. One of those special offers. Got it on the internet. I always liked Killarney. The mountains, the scenery. Just something about the place. Two nights B&B evening meal for one evening, very reasonable. The big hotel opposite Muckross. She said she'd drive. Had a call to make on the way, business in Cork City. Drives a nice car, Julie does. Audi A3, sportsback, 2 litre with the white leather seats. It was weird, you know, packing my bag for a weekend away on my own. Well, not on my own, but without Michael or the family or that. Get you out of yourself, Julie said. It was nearly dark, we pulled into the hotel car park. So we knocked back our complimentary cocktails in the bar and got the lift up to the 4th floor. She got us an upgrade at reception. She's like that, Julie, real businesswoman. The place was packed, some conference or something for the weekend. Crowds of fellas in suits all over the place. Never know your luck in a small town, I said. I knew Fiona didn't like the change of colour and the new hairstyle the last time they were down. They were already in the house. She still has a key when I got back from the gym. Saw her looking at me top to toe. I'm not naturally blonde, but I think it does suit me. It wasn't that I wanted to colour the grey bits. I just wanted to change completely. What do you think of your new nana? Says Paddy to the twins. It suits you, he smiled. Takes years off you. Every chance she got that weekend, Fiona kept going on about your new image. How she thought I was after changing, new clothes and all that. I'd emptied wardrobes of old stuff I'd had for years. The charity shops loved to see me coming. And about how women should wear clothes that were what she called age-appropriate. Cheek of her. Oh, now it got a bit bitchy at times. And of course she made some comments about what she referred to as your new friend and wondered what Daddy would think. Your father's dead, I heard myself say to her. She didn't like that. The words just came out and I couldn't take them back. Your dad was no hero, I said, and I know that he died before his time. And his cancer and the way he died was not pleasant for any of us. That doesn't make him some kind of a hero. I know we all said nice things about him towards the end, the funeral and all that. But a bastard is still a bastard, even in the oncology ward or even in the mortuary. And there's a fair share of bastards out there in Ballinasia. And I'm not going to make heroes out of them just because they're dead or they died before their time. Oh, now it was hot and heavy for a while. Yes, I said. Your father and I loved each other once, but it faded away and it was all a long time ago. We got a fabulous room, great view, looking out over the lakes, really big too. Jesus, the bathroom was the size of most hotel rooms I've stayed in. Do you know the difference between a double and a twin room? Tell the truth, it never bothered me before. And when she saw my face, she was already lifting the phone for reception. Look, it's grand, I said. And besides, it was one of those king-size things, you know, took up half the room. It's fine, I said. And anyway, after a nice meal and a few bottles of wine, you probably won't hear me snoring, I said. I'll be out cold. When we went back down, the place was bopping. Every seat in the bar and out in the lobby was taken. The blast of noise and excitement as soon as the elevator door slid open. People talking really loud and guffaws of laughing from groups gathered here and there in the crowded lobby. Something to do with sales and marketing posters all over the place. Leveraging the economy and consolidating the future or something. Jesus, what does all that shite mean? The dining room was packed too. The waiter, Polish, says to us, much busy tonight, hotel full, when he showed us to our table. Your usual table, ladies? We both chimed in together laughing. He didn't see the joke. A young couple at a table across from us were having a real ding-dong of a row. Keep your voice down, he was saying to her through his teeth. The poor girl. Something about the kids racing up and down the elevators. Julie kicked me into the shin under the table. Memories are made of this, I smiled. And I could just see Michael and that teacher's face in him laying down the law and the head going, Jesus. While we were sitting outside in the lobby, we'd taken our wine out of us when we finished in the dining room. Two fellas sat down opposite us. These lovely soft leather armchairs. Jackets off and ties pulled down, pints on the table. Great conference, one of them said. Yeah, said Julie. The keynote speakers were really inspiring, she smiled. They were from Belfast, some big company we might have heard of. We didn't. And you're from? And just as I'm about to say, Waterford, Julie cuts me off. Microsoft, she says, innovative systems. Jesus, they looked impressed. Just flew back from the States yesterday for the conference. They leaned forward in their seats. Julie was gas, you know, winding them up at sales and queer opportunities and all that kind of thing. But I was flagging, starting to doze off. The wine and the long driving. About an hour later, I opened my eyes. A mobile phone beside the pints and the wine bottles on the table was buzzing. One of them, greyish beard and glasses, had his arm around the back of the couch behind Julie. And you could tell from he was giving it his best shot. You know, all smiles, eye contact, and a little touch in her arm once or twice. "Has anyone told you that you're a ringer for Kate Blanchett?" he said. Julie laughed at him. "And has anyone told you that you're a ringer for Jerry Adams?" And they both threw their heads back at hysterics. My fella was gone by then. Don't know whether he was gone to the Jacks or gone to the bar, but his phone and his key card were still on the table. The noise in the place and the crowds, 'twas like Christmas or New Year's Eve in the hotel. Loud music coming out of the ballroom and that giddy excitement you feel in the air. People almost shouting at each other and everything seemed exaggerated. A waiter brought over 2 pints, another bottle of red and a brandy for each of us. Halfway through the bottle, the four of us were heading for the ballroom. I thought it was Brass and Co that were playing, real show band music, and everyone seemed to be kicking it up in the crowded dance floor. I don't know what that aftershave is. You see it in TK Maxx, but your mum was reeking of it. His head on my shoulder and his arms wrapped around my back. I could feel him getting hard up against me. And once or twice I felt his hand on my bottom. Julie winked at me when she and her fella brushed against us. He was whispering something into her ear and she threw her head back laughing. He tried to kiss me a couple of times. And then I said, fuck this. And I walked back out to the lobby, sat down at the table. I could feel myself shaking. And I thought I was going to start crying for no reason. There was a text on my phone from Fiona. "Hope you're enjoying Killarney. See you next weekend," it said. It was just 10 to 2. People were standing around the lobby in small groups and taxis were coming and going out of the main door. The night porter was all business, full of "Good night now, sir, and safe home now." And as I'm sitting there after a while, my eyes opening and closing and my head falling forward, you know the way. And I just felt like rolling up and falling asleep right there on the couch. And then behind me, someone stood and leaned over me. And I felt these hands covering my eyes. And out from the ballroom, the sound of that old drifter song we used to sing at parties years ago. "Now, darling, say the last dance for me." And someone whispered into my ear softly, "Would you like to dance?" You could see people looking at us out on the dance floor. In between the tables, the bottle boys were busy clinking glasses and starting to stack chairs. A disco or something was going to start as soon as the band had left the stage. I just wanted to be held, like a child warm and snug. And it feels as though I'm just standing there in one spot, not moving, just swaying. And then, as we're gently moving along the dance floor, a man in a group at the table shouts in a thick Kerry accent, "Fair play to you, ladies," as we slowly swayed past. And he turned and winked to his wife. I don't know how long we just swayed and swooned to that music. My eyes closed as we leaned against each other. My arms around her waist, holding her against me. Her arms around my neck. My forehead on her shoulder. A gold earring she wore against my cheek. Once or twice she whispered something into my ear. And we both laughed when we leaned our foreheads against each other. Our eyebrows touching, our noses touching. I don't know how long we both held on to each other as that music was playing, but it seemed to last forever. And then I heard a whisper into my ear, "Make a wish, Maura." So I did. And I wished that that moment would last forever. Julie said something about a nightcap. So while I stood waiting for the elevator door to open, she headed back into the bar. "Two brandies and a Coke for the ladies," I heard the barman shout. Lying in bed in the dark room, I could feel my head throbbing. In the warm air, I could faintly hear the thump-thump from the ballroom downstairs. Occasionally, a door would open and the noise would splash out. And then it would quieten again as quickly. I heard her slide her keycard into the door lock, push the door in and close it slowly. In the dark, she sat down at the edge of the bed. A sliver of light under the bathroom door and the sound of her high heels on the floor tiles, her necklace and jewellery on the oak dressing table, and the rustle of her clothes as she undressed. the sound of her feet and the soft carpet as she made her way to the bed in the dark. And she crawled in under the sheet. "Don't be messing," she said. "I know you're awake." "What happened to the Belfast Brigade?" I whispered. "Chucky Arlaw," she said. "Jesus." We both started giggling. "Are you okay?" she whispered. "Yes," I said. "Sure?" "Sure," I said. Under the sheet, her hand found mine. She held it. "You're great. Do you know that?" "And so are you," I said, our fingers interlacing. "You're not mad at me?" she asked. "For what?" I smiled. "This," she said. "The room." "Don't be silly," I whispered. It had been years since Michael and I had kissed each other. A full kiss, I mean, on the lips and all that. Or anything more. We'd pretty much given up on all of that. And after, our troubles and then his illness. Well, it just sort of got lost somewhere. It was a comfort, though, at times, just to hold someone. The girls, even when they were home. But that was it, really. "Do you think it'd be warm enough?" Julie giggled, her lips and thumb wet against my ear. I could smell and taste the brandy off her breath. "I'll take my chances," I whispered as her arm drew me against her. We lay across each other without a word. And then, without even a thought, I felt her turn her mouth, her lips to mine. And I did too. Felt her lips, her tongue, her mouth on mine. She could feel my heart pounding as I held her palms against my breast. "Do you want me to?" she asked. "Yes," I said. "Yes." And she did. Later, lying there, my arm around her like a child, watching her shoulder rise and fall as she slept, she shivered a little as the night got colder, and I drew the cover up over her bare back. I kissed her gently on the shoulder. I could hear the wind stirring on the tops of the trees across towards Mockris and the other lakes, as dawn was creeping in off the Atlantic. Over the reeks, and down the wet valleys, to that hotel room where we lay together. That same wind was blowing eastwards, along the valleys of the Lee and the Blackwater, in over the Comeres and across the wide empty beaches, stirring the tops of the marram grass, all along the sand dunes and the Soleen, and in over the dark water of the Backstrand, to that gravestone in the cemetery, near the water's edge.
You've been listening to Terms and Conditions by Noel Kelly. Maura was played by Lorraine Murphy, sound by David Hayes and Paul Grant, executive producer Michael Grant, made with the assistance of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.